I was asked to review geodesic motion and relativistic astrophysics. I worked on that for rather a lot of years. And I think for you here in the Capra meeting, it's probably most interesting as a leading order that you are looking on. Okay, so let me start. So this is the outline of my talk. I will first give you a short introduction into the topic and then tell you something about test particle motion and also a little bit about spinning particles, and in particular about analytical solution methods for these kind of equations. Then I will go a little bit into the particular topic of bounded motion on fundamental frequencies and so on. And then at the end, something on very special orbits, but nevertheless very important orbits, so circular and spherical motion, and then I will summarize. So let's start with an introduction. And just to remind us why we are actually doing all this. So as you all know, of course, black holes and neutron stars are very exciting in the sense that they generate very strong gravitational fields. And I think all of us want to know something more about the nature of gravity and the theory of gravity. So our ultimate goal is somehow to understand more about gravity itself, or at least my goal. So if we want to have some information about gravitational fields, we cannot measure that directly. We need to measure instead either electromagnetic radiation or gravitational wave, or both. And for both channels, say, both for electromagnetic radiation and for gravitational wave, we need to have usually some knowledge about the motion of objects, and for EM radiation, also about the motion of light, of course. So to learn at all something about gravity, we need to know something about the motion of objects in gravitational fields. And this is where we are looking on. So we're looking on some kind of binary motion, and that is generally described, of course, by the field equation. So whatever field equation you prefer, actually, I think most probably use the Einstein field equation, but of course you can look at something more general. Here in my talk today, I will mainly speak about Einstein's equation, sometimes Einstein-Maxwell, and sometimes also something which is more general, which comes from alternative theories and so on. For this talk, I will also assume extreme mass ratios. So if you look onto this diagram here that probably all of you know very well, we are looking somewhere in this area here. So where we have a small mass ratio, so we have a very massive primary and a much less massive secondary. And in particular, I will look here only onto the leading order term, so on the geodesic motion, which would mean that we actually go here to infinity. What I will also talk a little bit about is some inner structure of the particle, so of the secondary, the less massive particle in the system, and I will a little bit talk about also about charge and about spin. And all of what I'm presenting here today is about exact analytical methods. So I will usually not go into the post-Newtonian regime. I will really look onto the analytic solution without approximations. Of course, within the idealized setting that I just explained. And just as a reminder, I know that most of you are looking onto the cell force, some also on through spin and so on. But of course, geodesic motion also covers the propagation of electromagnetic signals. And also, what I find also very interesting, it also covers clocks in gravitational fields. Okay, so let's come to the geodesic motion, the test particle motion. And there was really a lot of progress in the last, say, decades in that area. But to do anything, of course, we have to assume some basic symmetries here. So usually we assume stationarity, so the existence of a time-like Killing vector, that gives us some conserved energy, and we assume axial symmetry, so with some space-like Killing vector that gives us a conserved angular momentum. And from that, we can then write down a rather general form of the metric here in Boyer-Lindquist coordinates, which looks like this here. So it's diagonal plus the O phi terms. And then from the two Killing vectors here, from energy and angular momentum, we can already derive the equations of motion in time and in phi direction. And then, of course, we have the normalization of the four velocity with one for time-like and zero for light-like particles. And then we get from this normalization, if you write that out and using these two equations here, you get this expression here very generally. And now this is the point where you need to have something in addition. Yeah. So if you want to decouple this equation, you see it still depends on R and theta. So all the metric coefficients here are assumed to depend on R and theta only. And if you want to decouple this, then you have really to take a look at the metric coefficients and see if they decouple or not. Of course, for Kerr spacetime, which is the most interesting spacetime for astrophysical applications, Carter already showed that in, I think, 1968, that this equation already decouples. He did this by looking at the Hamilton-Jacobi equation, but actually it's not possible, not necessary. You can do that directly from this equation here also. So you can see that this equation actually separates if there's a force constant of motion, of course, and it separates if you can split the metric coefficients or combination of metric coefficients here in this form here with some functions F, G, and capital F and capital G. Note here that this here and here, these are the same factors, so to say. And for Kerr spacetime, this is just what is usually called sigma or rho squared. This is R squared plus A squared cosine squared theta. And then if you have such a structure in your equation, which is not only for Kerr spacetime, of course, but also for Kerr-Newman and even more general spacetimes, then you can introduce a new parameter, which is sometimes called the Minotine. You can introduce it like this here, and then you get a very nice decoupled form of the equations of motions here. And this can be done directly from that normalization equation, as I just explained. Okay, but this existence of a force constant, or which is of course linked to the existence of a Killing-Jarno tensor, by the way, so to so-called hidden symmetry of the space-time. If you have that, sorry, this was my son. I asked him not to, but yeah. Okay, so this is then the structure of the equations, but this existence of a force constant is in some sense rather special. So of course you have that for the Kerr-Newman spacetime, and you can also add additional parameters like the NAC parameter, the cosmological constant, then you would call something like this a Kerr-Newman NAC de Sitter spacetime maybe. You could also say it's a Plebanski-Demyansky spacetime without acceleration, that would be actually the same. So we have like seven parameters in the spacetime. And there are a lot of other spacetime from, say, different alternative theories where you can also have this force constant of motion. There are some higher dimensional models also with, say, non-trivial black hole configurations like black strings, black rings, black Saturns, and so on. You can also go into lower, so three-dimensional spacetime, BTZ spacetime, and so on. Then there are some regular black hole models, regular meaning here that you do not have a singularity at the center. This can be achieved, for example, by introducing a non-linear electrodynamics. for example, of the Blavatsky class. This could be, for example, the Bardeen model or the Eon-Beato-Garcia spacetime and others. Then there are some parametrized spacetimes that are, so to say, theory independent, where you can also have such a force constants of motion. And probably there are more. I do not claim that this list is exhaustive. So in a sense, yes, it's very special, but in another sense, I think the most important astrophysical settings are captured by the existence of this force constant. And here on the right, by the way, you see two nice pictures of, this is a nut spacetime where you have a motion on a cone. And this is here Kern-Newman spacetime with an electrically charged particle. What is generally problematic for the existence of this constant, or say non-existence of this constant, is if you have hairs in your spacetime. This is what is called hairs. So if you have some perturbations from the environment, this is generally very difficult because you usually do not have any symmetry in that. And if you have something like black hole imposters, say boson stars and so on, where you only have numerically given spacetimes, then usually you will not have something like this force constant of motion or any constant maybe at all, actually. And if you do not have this force constant, then in general, you will have some chaotic motion in the system because it's not completely separable. And then say, there might be exceptions from this rule, but in general, you will have some chaotic motion. But this does not mean that you cannot not have, for example, say, still some regular motion in specific regions of the spacetime. Say, for example, if you have a reflection symmetry to the equatorial plane, you might have a stable motion in the equatorial plane or something like that. Okay, so if you have the separability, then in almost all cases that I looked upon in all, say, 10 years or something, almost always you can reduce your system of equations to a form like that here. So you get some ordinary differential equation where the right-hand side is given here by a rational function, capital R, which depends on your spacetime coordinate x and the square root of some polynomial in x. And it, of course, there are also some parameters of the spacetime or of the particle, so on here. But they can be chosen constant, of course. And actually, most commonly, it looks a little bit simpler. Most commonly, you have something like dr over d some parameter is equal to the square root out of some polynomial. So there are some, or say a very special case of that problem is the Kepler problem. In that case, this polynomial P here is of order 1 or 2, and you can solve this ODE in forms of elementary functions, so sine, cosine, and so on. This is the most simple case. Then you can go to the a bit more complicated case where P has 3 or 4 zeros, is of order 3 or 4, then you will have to solve this in terms of elliptic functions. And this is, for example, the case in the Kern-Newman nut spacetimes in the family of this spacetime, including all subcases, of course, like Schwarzschild and so on. And if you do that, if you have that kind of problem, then actually, if you once know how to do it, it's rather easy to write down the solution. And instead of giving you all the details how to do that, I decided just to point you to two, I think, very nice reviews. The first one is by Sharp. It's really excellent, from 1979. Of course, it can only cover papers up to that point. And Lemmertzahl and myself, we wrote also a review in 2015, where we shortly explain how this solution procedure goes. And also that contains also a guide to the literature where you find all the solutions to this different space times and so on listed. And the general approach is actually rather simple. You just need to reduce this kind of equation here to some general standard form by using a given set of substitutions. And if you have done that, you can just write explicitly down the solution just as you do it with a sine or arcsine function. A little bit problem or complication saying that is that there is not really like agreed upon standard form as it is for sine and cosine and so on. So there are basically two major approaches to that. The first one is due to Jacobi. He introduced these functions SN, CN, DN, which are say, direct generalizations of the sine, cosine, and tangens. And actually they reduce to these functions in a certain limit. And the inverse of these functions are the integrals capital F, E, and pi. And they are just, you can think of this as generalizations of the arcsine, arccosine, and arctangens functions. What you also have to take care of here is that these functions are complex functions. So they have two periods, a real and a complex period. And you have to take care. So basically all the major computer algebra systems can take off this, can take care of this on their own, but then you may run into some problems with complex numbers, complex residues or so on your calculations. So it's better to ensure by choosing the, say, most appropriate standard form that everything is real. The other set is the Weierstrass functions, P and P prime, and the integral of this is called sigma. And it's of course, totally equivalent to this Jacobi set of functions, yeah? Actually, P and P prime span the space of all the elliptic functions. S and C and spans the space of all elliptic functions. So they are given by linear combinations in form of each other, yes? And as I said, all these functions are included in Mathematica, Maple, and I don't know, whatever major computer algebra system you prefer. What I wanted to say is these, as I said, these are complex functions, they have two periods, and this is why they are living on such a torus, actually. Yeah? So this is Riemann surface of Ganus 1, actually. So you have this red period here and this blue period here. Okay, so if this polynomial P here has an even higher order, then things get a bit messy, actually, yeah. So generally P can be of order 2G plus 1 or 2G plus 2, G gives you the genus of the Riemann surface where these functions live. Here below you see a surface of genus 2. So the G gives you the number of holes, say, in your surface. For G equal to 2, you get all these de Sitter spacetimes setups where you include a cosmological constant. You also get some more general spacetimes from alternative series where also you have to go to these higher order polynomials. This is, as I said, a bit messy. And to explain that solution method, actually, I would need to talk on its own to do that. But you can find the main procedure in these papers here. Again, here's also the review. I think this is actually the best point to start if you're interested in that. And then you need to do something which is called Klein and Sigma functions, or these are defined in terms of Riemann theta functions. And because they have 2G periods, meaning that they're living in the complex plane to the power G, you need to do some dimensional reduction also to solve your system, which means that you have to restrict your problem to some subalgebra. And in the case of G equal to 2, this is called the theta divisor. But the message that I want to give you here is that for all Petrov type D spacetimes, so meaning Kerr-Newman with NUT parameter, with cosmological constant, and for the case of light-like geodesics, also with an acceleration of the black hole, you can separate the equations of motion. You can express them as the ODE of the type I just showed, and you can explicitly solve the geodesic equation in terms of these elliptic or hyperelliptic functions. And well, maybe you say, why are you doing that? Maybe it's easier to numerically just integrate that. And yes, that might be true if you are looking just for one particular case. But if you want to learn something about the geodesics of the characteristics, their features, how they behave, then it's much better to have an analytical solution at hand, because a lot of information is known about these kind of functions. Yeah? In particular about the elliptic functions, they are more than, I think, 100 years old. Okay, I just want to mention shortly that you can also use this for the case of spinning particles if you assume a particular setup. So if you have the Matteson-Papagnetto-Dixon equations, meaning that you have a pole-dipole approximation from your energy derived from your energy conservation law, then you arrive at this equation here, plus some kind of spin supplementary condition that is necessary to close the system. It's underdetermined else. And there are several of the spin supplementary conditions around, and the different conditions correspond to different choices of the reference word line within the whirl tube of the particle. Meaning that you can, to every choice of the reference word line, you can find an observer who associates the reference word line with the center of mass. So for a kind of particular setup, that is, you take a Kerr space time and you go to the equatorial plane only, and to stay in this equatorial plane, you have to assume that the spin of the particle is aligned or anti-aligned. And if you assume that and take the sum observer, so the Tultius SSC, spin supplementary condition written down here, then you can again derive an ordinary differential equation, which looks like this type here, actually, no, more like this type here, there's a factor on front. And you can again solve this explicitly in terms of Kleinian sigma function, actually, the Ganus 2 problem. This is just a side note here. Okay, then I will come to the bounded motion, so to this particular case where we have some periodicities. And you see an example of this here, where you have some motion of some particle around a Kerr black hole, actually, here. And for this kind of bounded motion, you know that the radial motion is periodic, so it's between two extremal radial values. And the polar motion is periodic as well. It also oscillates between two extremal values, which are here indicated by these two cones here. And then from your equations of motions, you can just directly compute the radial period, which is here called capital lambda R, and the polar period, capital lambda theta, by integrating over one circle, say one cycle in your motion. And then the frequency, then you can associate a frequency to that, and so it's just 2 pi over the period. And this is, of course, again, for Kerr space, and for example, this is again explicitly given in terms of these elliptic integrals that I just showed to use in both cases here. So, but we do not only have the R and theta motion, we also have the phi, t, and actually tau motion, because for usually we cannot assume that we can have the proper time tau as the parameter along your curve, but you will have some parameter, so usually what is called the minor time. And these are not periodic, but they are, say, mainly linear. So they can be expressed as some linear function in lambda, in the minor time, plus some periodic oscillation upon this. And then you can make kind of this kind of ansatz. So you have some linear term here, which goes with what is called the phi frequency. And then you have some oscillations added to that. And this you can also determine again explicitly in terms of these intervals and so on. And you cannot only do this for phi, but analogously for tau and for t, of course. And this was for Kerr space times. This was worked out in the beginning by Schmidt, but he did not know this trick with the minor time, so he was not able to completely decouple the equations. Then there was something on the fundamental frequencies already in this 2004 paper by Trasko and Yu, and then Fujita Hikida in 2009 worked this out in detail. And myself and Lemmertzer, we generalized this to the Plemansky-Demjanjkin class of space-time. So this Kerr-Newman nut de Sitter space-times in 2012. So, well, these fundamental frequencies are a wonderful thing. I just want to give you one note here. This was found in 2013 by Warburton and co-authors, that the parametrization is actually not unique. You can have different orbits that have the same fundamental frequencies, actually. So this can only happen for, say, the partner orbit is very close to the black hole, but nevertheless, this might be of interest for some applications like in spirals and gravitational waves. I think there was some question.
Yeah, I see that Martin has a question. Oh, I have to unmute you.
Yeah, just a quick remark. At least appears that for the meantime frequencies, the parameterization actually is unique. It's just the proper time and coordinate time frequencies that have the hyper frequency doubling.
Please say again. So you mean the frequencies with respect to coordinate time and proper time? So the
frequencies with respect to mean time do not seem to have the Iser frequency.
Well, it's clear that in this paper, I think the coordinate times were discussed. Actually, I think yes, exactly.
Yeah.
But is there a proof that there is no
in the appendix of one of my 2003 papers, there's a proof for equatorial orbits. That's true. And lots for generic orbits that at least show that if they exist, they must exist in a very tiny sliver of parameters.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, thank you very much for that remark. Sorry. Okay. Then I think I can continue. Okay, using these fundamental frequencies, you can express a lot of observables actually in a very nice form. For example, you can just interpret the periapsis precession, which you see here, as a mismatch between the radial and the angular frequencies with respect to coordinate time. And then you can write the change with coordinate time of omega, so of the argument of the periapsis, as this expression here, where you have here the animalistic period, so the period from periastron to periastron passage. And the same thing you can do with the Lenz-Tiering effect, so with this change of the ascending node, which you can see here. And this is just a mismatch of the polar and the angular frequencies. And then you can write it exactly as here, like this. But now you have here the drakonitic period, so the period between two successive passages of the ascending node. So this is a very nice scheme, say, to define these kind of observables. And you can also use this to define an observable in terms of the frame dragging.
Raphael, raus hier. Ja, da steht dein Name. Raus hier und du störst mich nochmal, bitte.
The frame dragging, you can also use this fundamental frequency for an effect induced by frame dragging. Frame dragging, you all know, is induced by rotation and it's also sometimes called gravitomagnetism. And there were already two tests on that by the Lagios and Laris satellites that test the spin orbit coupling. So what I just showed you as the Lanza-Turing effect. And then Gravity Probe B testing the spin-spin coupling, also called the Schiff effect. And there's another effect that you might not be aware of, and that is the gravitomagnetic clock effect. But I think I have to hurry up a little bit to show a little bit more. Just let me tell you very quickly what this gravitomagnetic clock effect is. So Cohen and Michoud introduced this in 1993, and they had this setup here in mind. So you have two clocks on an equatorial circular orbit, on the same equatorial circular orbit, one going prograde and the other retrograde. And then you measure the proper orbital period, so after an angle of 2 pi, and compare the times of the two clocks. And Cohen and Michoud found that you can write this as approximately 4 pi j over mc squared, where j is the angular momentum of the central object and m the mass. And if you insert the values for the Earth here, then you get a time difference of about 10 to minus 7 seconds, which is, if you think of the accuracy of orbits of clocks in orbit, then this seems like a rather large effect, actually. So this is, however, not very well suited for experiments because you need perfectly identical circular orbits and you need identical initial conditions, which is actually not feasible, of course. So you need some kind of more general definition. So something like this would be nice, where you have two arbitrary clocks going around the Earth, somehow comparing their proper periods. And even more desirable would be something like that, yeah? So you have a black hole and you have some pulses, which are natural clocks going around this black hole. So let me just shorten this a little bit. So you can use fundamental frequencies to define a gravitomagnetic clock effect, this gravitomagnetic clock effect. And what you get is something like this here. So you compare the two periods such that you introduce a factor such that the gravitoelectric effects cancel. Then you can do, for convenience, a post-Newtonian expansion, which is given here. And you see that this here, this last term here, gives you what is called the gravitomagnetic clock effect. It looks very similar to what Cohen and Michoud derived, but for arbitrary eccentricities and inclinations. And you can look at that for, say, a pulsar in a one-year orbit around Sagittarius A star or something like that. And then you will see that this is a rather large effect. So it should be very well measurable with pulses closely orbiting Sagittarius A star, for example. So as you see, that could be, depending a bit on the orbital configuration, it could be up to 200 seconds or something. So a really large effect. But you need very precise tracking because the Kepler period is very large compared to this gravitomagnetic clock effect. So small perturbations in the orbit will induce very large uncertainties in this effect. And this is also the reason why it was not measured until now with satellites around the Earth, by the way. So the orbit tracking is not good enough. Okay, let me spend 2-3 minutes on circular motion, maybe, if I'm allowed. Yeah. Okay. Circular or spherical motion is, in a sense, very important for observations because, for example, if you look at the black hole with an accretion disk, the motion within the accretion disk can be very well approximated by circular motion. if you look onto the inner edge of the accretion disk, it should be located at or close to the innermost stable circular orbit, or depending on your model, maybe what is called the marginally bound orbit, so the orbit where you can just escape to infinity. And of course, very important, the photon region, so the region of spherical photon motion. This is very important, of course, for shadow observations, so EHT observations and so on. And so in principle, this would be very nice objects to test our theory of gravity, actually. But I want to give you some note of care here, say, because all these spherical and circular orbits are, of course, sensitive to all the parameters that you have in your system. So, of course, to your space-time parameters, mass and rotation usually, and this is what you often want to test for, but they are also sensitive to charge, also if it is very, very small. So if you have like electrons or so on, free electrons going around, and it's very sensitive also to extremely tiny charges of the black hole, to say non-Kerr multipoles that you have, or signatures of alternative series and so on. Then you have the parameters of the particle. So you may have charge in the game, you may have spin in the game, or whatever you're looking on. And then you have some perturbations from the environment. You can have some other bodies flying around. You can have some external electromagnetic fields, like from the galaxy or whatever, or some magnetars that are close by or whatever. And I just wanted to point out here, so what you see here in the pictures is the radius of the marginally stable orbit here on the left in a parametrized space-time by Rizzolanzi-Denkhol. And this is, say, designed to capture signatures of alternative gravity models. And you see that in, so what you see here are contours of constant radius of the marginally stable orbit in terms of the mass, so units of the mass, the black hole. And you see that in certain directions, it's rather insensitive to these signatures of alternative theories. In other directions, it is very sensitive to signatures of alternative gravity. So if you have something like this here, a direction where it's not very sensitive, and you have some other parameters in your game, like electromagnetic fields or whatever, then it would generally be very, very hard to use these kind of orbits, special orbits, to constrain your theory of gravity. On the right here, you see something very similar, because actually most of the time we cannot observe the radius, but we can observe the frequency of the circular orbit. And here you see basically the same thing, but for the frequency of the marginally stable orbit. And you see that at least for this particular space-time here on the lower right, it follows more or less this here, but here you see some interesting things happening actually. So it's not clear from the very beginning that you can map your frequency to the radius straightforwardly, actually. So let me skip what I wanted to say else on circular and spherical motion. I want to say something on charged particles in Kerr-Newman space-time, or if we have some external electromagnetic test fields and charged particles that can also influence your ISCO and marginally bound orbit positions, or if you have a spinning particle that might be most interesting for most of you. This can also have, of course, some influence on the position of the marginally stable and marginally bound orbits. And what I just wanted to mention here, so if you have actually very slowly spinning central black hole and a very large anti-aligned spin, then actually your ISCO may become retrograde, which is rather surprising, I guess. Okay, so let me summarize at this point.
Do you think we can skip the summary and go straight into the questions?
Yeah, we're sure.
Running a bit over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you sure. Can, yeah, you can read the slide. Summary yourself, I guess.
Okay, well, thank you very much for a wonderful talk. Well done. And so we've had a couple of questions, including from inside your home. So I see that Sarp has a question. Do you want to ask it live? I guess the answer is no. Any questions? I don't see anything coming up.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Sorry, my Zoom screen disappeared, Eric, as you were talking, and I couldn't retrieve it. So, the question was simple. The figure you showed about the pulsar orbiting Sagittarius A star and this effect, you said it could be as large as a few hundred seconds. How close would the pulsar need to be? Like less than an AU, few AUs, do you know?
Well, this example that I showed there assumed a 1 year orbit. So that would be rather close to the black hole. If you go farther outside, it would of course be smaller, yeah? But say if you have, but not so much actually. So if you would have just a guess, I did not compute it. So I guess if you have like a 10 years orbit, then you would still have like 10 seconds or something. My expectation.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, there's a question from...
But assuming is extreme mass ratio, of course, yeah? So this was only geodesic motion.
Mm-hmm. Yep, there's another question from Yang Lu.
Yes, just a naive question about the spinning particles. From the MPD equation, sometimes we normally to treat the spin of the black hole, of the particle, to use some kind of like the spin vector. And just want to ask if we ignore the cell force, and will the vector change during the motion because of something like the retarded thing or the drag thing.
If you assume from the very beginning that the particle is in the equatorial plane and you have only an aligned spin or an anti-aligned spin, then the spin will stay aligned or anti-aligned, and the particle will also stay in the equatorial plane. Stable.
But what about the off-equatorial layer, will it change?
Off-equatorial, you cannot do with this formalism because the equations are not separable. As soon as you go outside of the equatorial plane, you cannot have like a fixed spin or something. You would need to introduce this precessing spin and also, of course, a precessing orbit. So, and this is generally, this is chaotic motion, yeah? So, you can just not separate the equations.
Okay, so thank you.
Okay, thank you. There was a question from Victor.
Thank you. I would like to ask, is it possible to analytically calculate the frequencies and the trajectory of spinning particle in the equatorial plane if you know the constants of motion and not the roots of the polynomial in the radial equation?
So, I mean, if you know the constants of motions, you can, of course, compute the roots of the polynomial. And then everything is given, if this answers your question. So then you can exactly, if you are in Kerr spacetime or Kerr-Newman spacetime, this wouldn't change anything. And you have the spinning particle in the equatorial plane with this aligned, anti-aligned setup, then you can do that. Yes.
Thank you.
Okay, I don't see any more questions. We have time for one more, I believe. Any takers? Yes, there's a question from Jelly Lee.
Hello, thank you for the nice talk. So I was wondering, will you include spin in the MPD equation? There is a modified formula for the energy, conserved energy, and there's a modified formula for conserved angular momentum. So how about Cantor constant? Is there any constant of motion like related to Kirayama tensor?
No, I'm not aware of that. So I think as soon as you have spin in the game, you cannot have a Carter constant. Of course, as you correctly said, energy and angular momentum will change, but there's still, so we have a modified expression for that, but they are still constants. But you cannot have a Carter constant for spinning particles and for the general motion, general case. Yes. This is unfortunately impossible.
So for the special case of equatorial plane and align or anti-align spin, is there a Carter constant?
Well, in this case, you don't need a Carter constant because you can restrict everything to the equatorial plane, and then you do not need a force constant of motion.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.